Welcome to Holden Village. Today is the 25th of July, 1995. In the Creekside room this morning, our speaker is Kathy Bosch, and she will be speaking on Life is Uncertain, Eat Dessert First. So let's listen in on Kathy.
If this describes your life, look inside for a new product from the makers of Tylenol. And it says, if the kids are arguing, or you lost your credit card, missed connecting flight, lost baggage, power failure, blind date, snowstorm, leaky faucet, job interview, toilet overflows, broken shoelace, inconsiderate smokers, bounced check, no parking space, out of deodorant. If you have experienced any of those problems, just open this up and take out a Tylenol, and all your problems will be solved. Well, wouldn't it be nice if life were like that? And we could solve our problems and feel what we want to feel just by taking a pill. Unfortunately, life is not that way. So we're going to look at some things about self-esteem. And one that I'm reminded of as a basis for renewing, and self-esteem is a continuous, ongoing process. So I look at 1 John 3, verses 1a and 2, and it says, see what love the Father has given us, that we should be called children of God. Beloved, we are God's children now. What we will be has not yet been revealed. What we do know is this: when he is revealed, we will be like him, for we will see him as he is. But that we are God's children now, not when we finish A, B, C, D, and E, not when we get enough points, not until we collect so many years of seniority, but now we are God's children. So let's look at self-esteem and see what we can do about building ours and looking at joy and eating dessert first. I like Peanuts cartoons. And sometimes I think I could do a whole class on just Peanuts or any of the other cartoons that are on. But here's Marcy, and is it Peppermint Patty? And Peppermint Patty saying, I think it all depends upon how you look at yourself, Marcy. And she's talking in her seat. And all of a sudden, the teacher asks a question. She says, yes, ma'am. Well, let's see. I'll say 15. Rats, wrong again. But I still have self-esteem. Now, how many of us could keep that going? Or here's Arlo and Janice. And they're sitting on the sofa, and Arlo's reading the paper, and Janice says, I'm so fat. And he's reading his paper, and he says, you're not so fat. And she says, I'm so ugly. And he's still reading his paper and says, you're not so ugly. And she doesn't say anything. And he says, you're not dumb. And he looks over and he says, sorry, got ahead of you a bit. programmed in. And here's Nancy, wiping, wipe, 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 pat, pat, pat. All right, way to go, good girl. Sluggo comes in and says, I can always tell when it's your turn to do the dishes. And Nancy says, the secret to motivation is positive feedback. Pat, pat, pat. Some of us need to be reminded about that we do very well at putting ourselves down. Wow, stupid I am. What a dumb thing to do. Instead of saying, well, that was a mistake. What can I learn from it? Jack Canfield has written a lot of things about self-esteem, and he's got, what's the book that we just picked up? Chicken Soup. No, I forgot to bring it. Chicken Soup. More stories. Chicken Soup for Life.
For the soul.
Chicken Soup for the Soul. And then he's got more Chicken Soup for the Soul. And it's a series of little stories that he has heard from people in the various workshops that he's been in. And it's really quite neat. And quite interesting. But he's done a lot of things, such as 100 Ways to Improve Self-Esteem in the Classroom, and has done a lot of workshops, particularly with teachers, to help them help students feel okay about themselves. So there's a lot of things out. A couple of other things let me just show you, too, that are in the bookstore. One is Growing Up Again. parenting ourselves and parenting our children. And this is really for all ages. And when I do parenting courses, I use a section out of here that talks about the stages of self-esteem. And it goes through 7 stages of self-esteem, from birth up to adulthood. And what I really like about it is that there are 8 sections to each stage. One is the job of the child, or the job of that stage, the developmental task. 2 would be typical behaviors for that stage. 3, affirmations for being. For instance, we might say to that baby, "I'm glad you're alive. I'm glad you're here. You belong here." 4, helpful parent behaviors. 5 is unhelpful parent behaviors. And then on 6, it switches over. And it says, clues to a need for adults to grow up again. 7 is activities that support adults growing up again in this particular stage. And 8, affirmations for being when you feel ready as that adult, working again to renew and remind yourself of what's important at this stage. Like, I'm glad I'm alive. I belong here. I'm glad I'm me. Jean Ilsley Clark, who has written this, has gone on to even produce little oval shape with plastic covers on the front and back, from small size to large size that you can post on a wall. But the small size ones, you know, you could put in your pocket. Choose one. And as you go around, you usually put your hands in your pocket every now and then, and every time you touch it, it sort of reminds you to remind yourself, to self-affirm for that particular focus. And what we want to look at also is that self-esteem is not a once and for all. It's a womb to tomb process. It starts when you're born and it continues. So that when, even if you've had a very difficult, very stressful, very unfulfilled childhood from your perspective, you can't say, "Well, it was all my parents' fault that they didn't do." Because now as an adult, you can choose. You can reparent yourself. You can refocus yourself. You can renew yourself. And so that's a very helpful thing. Back in Syracuse, New York, when Paul was campus pastor at Syracuse University, we knew a student who had come from a very under-functioning family. His father was a professional engineer, but had some unusual rules for the family. One was, no one could use the telephone except father. And even when he was gone for work or gone for a period of time, off to another place, nobody was supposed to use the phone because it was supposed to be available because he called. And occasionally, he would call home, and if anybody answered the phone, he would blast them saying, "You're not supposed to answer this, this is my phone." That's just an example of how one of the things she grew up with. Well, on several occasions, she called our house at 2 o'clock in the morning and it would ask Paul to come and pick her up from a certain corner in Syracuse and to take her to Upstate Medical Center, which had a psychiatric treatment center. And she'd be there a few days and then she'd be back out and get into her classes, and she was a fairly responsible student. But this happened a couple of times. And one time, I was visiting another family from our campus parish, a single parent who had 4 children between the ages of 6 and 12. And this young woman that I just mentioned earlier was often a support system for this single parent. And in her good days, she's a very responsible, secure person, so there wasn't any real question about, is she going to do something to these kids? But she, this young woman and this single parent had become quite good friends. And while I was visiting the single parent friend, the young student came in very agitated. She had just, at that point, she was seeing a psychiatrist daily. She had just come off from writing herself in or admitting herself, and she had been let out, but she was seeing the psychiatrist daily. And she had come from the psychiatrist's office, and she was so upset. I don't know how the psychiatrist could have left her out if she was that way when she finished with her hour or whatever amount of time it was. But she was very upset. And we said, "What is happening?" And she said, "I just discovered why I shouldn't be living. Why sometime I will succeed at taking my life." A couple of times she had attempted suicide. And we all said, "What did you discover?" And she said, I discovered that I was an unplanned child. I was unwanted. Whereupon my friend just broke into uproarious laughter. And both the student and I looked at her, thinking, you know, this friend was doing graduate work in public health nursing. And I thought she would have known a little bit better that this kind of response would not be very appropriate. And I guess she thought we were really rather puzzled. And she said, well, let me explain. You said you were an unwanted child. Well, actually, 3 of the 4 of my children were unplanned. And I can't remember which one was planned. But I would never have told them that. And I would never let them know that they were not to be here. That whether they were planned or not, they're here. And so now it's my job to make their being here the best that it can possibly be. And you are an adult now, and you are doing well as a student, and now it's up to you to make your being here be the best that it can be, and what you can contribute to the people around you, because you have contributed mightily in my situation when I needed you, when I have to go off to a class and the kids couldn't stay by themselves. So you have a reason for being here. Well, the girl just relaxed. And as far as I know, she never went back to admit herself in the psychiatric center. And that, those words of wisdom from our mutual friend probably did more than all the psychotherapy she had gotten to say, you know, I'm here, now what can I do? I'm okay. I may do some dumb things sometimes, but I can learn from them. And so we want to look at that also. Here's another book that's in the in the bookstore here by Kenneth Erickson, who has been on the staff at Holden a number of times. It's called Helping Your Children Feel Good About Themselves, A Guide to Building Self-Esteem in the Christian Family. That might be another one you want to take a look at. Both Growing Up Again and Helping Your Children with Self-Esteem are in the bookstore and are very helpful. I think I got my first copy of Growing Up Again. I think I'm on my third copy now. People, when I show it at a class, people like to look at it and then think it's so good they walk off with it. But it is a very good book, both for adults and for whether you're actively parenting children now or just want to look at reviewing and re-encouraging yourself.
Okay.
Yes?
Would you speak into the microphone, please?
Okay.
Into this microphone.
Okay.
Thanks.
So let's take a look at some things about self-esteem. What is it? Well, it's your self-image, really, how you feel about yourself, how you value yourself. Not putting a price tag on yourself, but that I have some gifts to offer. And I can receive gifts from others as well. What is self-esteem made of? Well, thoughts and feelings you have about yourself and about those around you, whether they're positive or negative. And sometimes our perceptions, how the way we see things, may be very different from the way somebody else sees things. And that's helpful to talk about sometimes. 2 basic components of self-esteem. One is the sense of basic worthiness, okayness. I'm okay and you're okay. If I'm okay, you don't have to be not okay. Or if you're okay, that doesn't mean I'm not okay. We can both be okay. And a sense of competency, that we see ourselves as capable, that we can try some things. And, you know, a perfectionist is the kind of person who wants to succeed at something before they begin trying to learn about it. You know, that we can't make some mistakes. We're so fearful. So to see myself as capable, and that there'll be some steps forward and some steps backward, and that eventually there'll be more forward than there are backwards, but that we can learn. Jack Canfield also says, you can't learn less. Right? Even if you make a mistake, hopefully you'll at least learn what not to do again another time, or you can learn something from it. If we begin to look at it being as okay as making a mistake. To meet your own needs and to contribute to meeting others' needs. That we have a participation in this world. It's not just all giving and I take, but that it's a sharing. Self-esteem is learned, and because it's learned, it can also be unlearned. So any of the habits that we may have learned sometime in our growing up, we can always review and decide, is this fitting right now? And if it's not fitting right now, what would fit better? So if we've grown up with, you always think of yourself last, and don't ever do anything for yourself because that's very selfish, then you get into an airplane, and the stewardess flight attendant, got to be gender free. The flight attendant goes through the buckling of the belt, and if there's a problem with air pressure, then something will fall down. And notice what they say. If you are traveling with somebody, with a young child or somebody who's incapacitated, put your mask on first and then place the mask on the other. Why? Doesn't that sound selfish? I'll do my first and forget about the other? No, it's not, because maybe a child will fight getting it on, and you work a long time, and you may end up not having enough oxygen yourself to finish that job, let alone do yours. Put yours on quickly. Then you've got time to deal with whatever problems the other might pose. So there's a point at which we need to think of ourselves, to give ourselves that inner feeding, that inner nurturing that allows us to then nurture outside of ourselves. So if we've come up through our lives with, think of yourself last, it's a terrible, horrible, very bad, no good thing to think about yourself. Then we also have to look at Saul Gordon's book, Life is Uncertain, Eat Dessert First. Sometimes we have to nurture ourselves in order to be able to feed somebody outside. So since something is learned, it can always be unlearned and changed so that it is more positive for us. Self-esteem is a process, not a one-time accomplishment. We go through by practicing, trying. We remind ourselves of affirmations, of the various stages that we go through, that it's okay to be here. It's okay to make a mistake. I can learn from others. It's okay to be wrong on occasion, and I can figure out what went wrong and how can I do something differently next time. We need to affirm ourselves in ways that are meaningful to us, and I'll read you some affirmations that might be helpful at times, and you can choose which ones you might want to remind yourselves of, and that you can do it as your own self-affirmation. And we need to learn, and that's another learned thing, to believe that we are lovable. Sometimes, a good amount of the time, we don't feel very lovable. We feel everybody else has everything and I don't have anything, and we're very much a victim. We feel that we're a victim, and we have to find ways to say, I'm not a victim, I'm a survivor. In fact, we're all survivors here. If you weren't a survivor, you wouldn't be here, first of all. And second of all, we're really all survivors of another very important race. And that's the sperm race. If the particular sperm that happened to unite with that ovum was not the one that did, you'd be somebody else. So in a sense, we're all winners. So just remember that when you feel low, you've won a marvelous important race. You've won that important sperm race. Self-esteem comes from within. It's not, well, you didn't say this to me, and you didn't give this to me, and you didn't do this for me. It's what, that's what we need to do with children, because they don't know how to be able to feed themselves. But as we become older and as children go off to school, we need to help them to learn, as we learn ourselves, that we can feed us from within. So that when somebody on the playground says to them, oh, you're a little shorty, to say, but I'm capable to hit that ball or to run or to do my work. I'm as tall as I need to be. Or if they say you're a string bean, to say, but I move very well and I'm just the right for me. Or if you're wearing glasses and somebody gives you a bad time about wearing glasses, to say, well, they help me to see you better, but I can take it off and then I don't have to look at you. You don't want to really put them down. Self-esteem is not competitive. I've got a better self-esteem than you do. So we don't have to take from somebody else in order to be okay. We can continue to give. We build our self-esteem by recognizing the positive and negative messages and experiences that life has offered us, and by making healthy decisions about these offerings. What about the negative and the positive? Do we say, oh, terrible, this is awful. Why me, Lord? Why me? Well, maybe because I just want to see how you'd manage it, or because I just felt cussed today, or because you're there. Well, I'm not sure what the answer would be. But how do we recognize that some of the negative things that we may experience in our life, whether it's with health or with job or whatever that experience is, what can we learn from it that can build? And what's the old poster that says, when life hands you a lemon, make lemonade? You can sit there and pucker your lips and say it's terrible, but you can make lemonade out of it too. Well, why should I think about my self-esteem? Because it affects the who and the what and the where all about us. The way we live, how we think, how we act, how we feel about ourselves and others, and how successful we are in achieving the goals that we are to achieve, that's possible for us to achieve. So, in a sense, when we talk about self-esteem, we're talking about how do we manage to get to where God has meant us to be. Do we try to make that pathway our pathway, or do we say, I don't want to go there, I want to find a different one? Well, what is self-esteem and how does it affect us? I want you to just do an exercise, and that's put your fist in the air and say, I'm enough.
Say what?
I'm enough.
I'm enough.
Do you feel like you're much? How about putting it up in the air with some force and say, I'm enough.
I'm enough.
Let's do it again. I'm enough. Okay. Let's do another exercise. And that's put your head down by your knees as if you're getting a headache or you're, and say, I feel great. Say, I feel great.
I feel great.
How do you feel?
Not great.
Okay. Now, pardon? What if you put your hand up in the air and say, I feel terrible? Try that. I feel terrible. It just doesn't compute right, does it? So sometimes we have to get our body in there with some of those encouraging words to ourselves and to say, I feel great. And maybe to even convince us, sometimes we need to do it before we'll believe it. Not wait until I really feel great and then I can say, I feel great. Sometimes it's the action that promotes the feeling. And so we may have to do some things within ourselves to help us to feel better about ourselves. Well, let's look at another thing about what we can call pulling your own strings. Wayne Dyer has written a book called Pulling Your Own Strings. And he's talking about how we can encourage ourselves and be more supportive of ourselves and not wait for somebody else to always be there to say, oh, how great you are. I'm so proud of you. One time when our older daughter was going into seventh grade. She had been a very good student through her elementary school through sixth grade, and we thought, okay, here she's going into junior high, starting seventh grade, lots of other kids coming in. Her grades aren't probably going to be as good as they might have been in the school that she's been in for 7 years. When her report card came home, it was a very good report card, and her father said, Anna, I'm so proud of you. And Anna, in her wisdom, said, Dad, I'm the one that walked a mile and a half to school every morning and a mile and a half back every afternoon. I'm the one that stood up in class. They still made him stand up in class then to answer questions when I didn't want to stand up and face the rest of the kids. I'm the one who wrote the tests and did the assignments. I can be proud of myself. You can be happy, delighted, and excited for me. Well, you know, how do we take ownership and take that ownership away from the person who really did the work and who really made the grade? So we can be happy, delighted, and excited for the things other people do. We can be proud of the things we do. Sometimes that's one of the things we learn. You shouldn't be proud of what you've done. Always diminish it. Always put it down. Oh, that wasn't anything. Oh, that's not much at all. Oh, no, it really doesn't look that good. It didn't work out right. And you find all sorts of excuses, right, everybody? Feel that we've done that, we know people who do that. Well, how can we say, well, thank you? Maybe just that thank you. Yeah, it did work out right. Yeah, I like it too. So, we want to look at who's pulling your strings. And that there's a location of control. It can either be outside or it can be inside. And what we want to encourage is more of that control from the inside, that you're not a puppet on a string and nobody's sitting there with a remote control making you do certain things. So we can look at some of the opposites. We talked yesterday about, in anger, about the shoulds, the musts, the haves, that cause problems for us. And we might want to, we might choose to. How do we make those choices? I was talking with somebody a few days ago about problem solving in some situations, and he said, I begin to look at that, not so much at problem solving as the choices that I make. I mean, I can choose to do some problem solving, I can choose to make some suggestions with somebody else and see what's going to work out best, but I have to make that choice, and I have to be responsible for taking that choice. And that's that inner control, that I am responsible rather than others are responsible and can be blamed. What was it that Walt Bowman said this morning in one of his words for the day about when things, when you're looking okay, it's because you've got somebody you can readily blame for whatever doesn't go wrong? Well, if you're smiling, if you're smiling when things go wrong, it's because you've got somebody else to blame for them. Okay, how can we be more self-responsible, that concept of ultimate responsibility? The external, that we trust others more and look to others to take charge rather than making that decision ourselves and taking that responsibility. To trust myself more. And if it doesn't work out, I have to take responsibility then for learning what went wrong. Not blaming, but learning what went wrong. That I'm in charge of my own life. And that I have a lot of guideposts, and I've got a lot of things to work through, and I can take that responsibility for myself. The external, lacking self-confidence, somebody else has to give it to me, I need it in that pill like the Tylenol pill, rather than increasing my own self-confidence. I can try this, I will give it a try and see how it works, I can learn, I can't learn less, I can learn something from it. When it's external control, you're more vulnerable to pressure from the outside, manipulation from the outside. And isn't that a concern that we have for a lot of our children? We used to just say teens, but it's not just teenagers. We need to start that very early in preschool years, too, not to be manipulated. I remember a parent telling me one time about her just four-year-old child coming back from the first day of nursery school after Christmas. Now, this is just a four-year-old, and at Christmas time, he had gotten a sweater that Grandma had knitted for him with a big teddy bear on the front, and he was so proud and pleased with that sweater, he wore it every day from Christmas on. She had to really beg, borrow, and really plead with him to take it off at night. He liked it so much. He wore it proudly off to nursery school that first day after Christmas vacation, came back, and he didn't have the sweater on. And Mom said, what happened to your teddy sweater? And he said, I'm never going to wear it anymore. Well, something must have happened, she said. Fortunately, she didn't say, yes, you are. But she said, something must have happened. And he said, yeah, Johnny says, what a stupid sweater. Who plays with teddy bears anymore? You're a baby. And I'm not going to be a baby, and I'm not going to wear it anymore. Manipulation, outside pressure, a four-year-old, not 14. Already it happens at four. So how do we help them to think for themselves and make decisions? To be able to say, well, aren't you lucky you don't have to wear the sweater? I like it. I'm okay. You're okay. I don't have to put you down in order for me to feel okay. And it's really not necessary for you to put me down in order for you to feel okay. Thinks for self, makes decisions. Still considering others. And Don't we get into this? What will the neighbors think? But what will the neighbors think, or what will so-and-so think? You know, you got to consider the whole world before you make a decision. As if they're peeking in your window all the time. Feels helpless, out of control, a victim, rather than pulling your own strings and tuning into that inner listening that says, what's going to be the best route for me to go? What's going to be the most helpful for me and those with whom my decision involves? Okay, so looking at that locus of control, how do we choose some of our behavior? And we can look at being either proactive or reactive. And that's another way of how we look at self-esteem and make some of our decisions. You know, whether we come from a power position that says, I will make the decision, or whether we wait back and say, well, I'll let somebody else make the decision for me, because they'll probably make it better than I do. If you're unsure about making that decision, then search out some more information so that you have the facts that you need sufficient to make that decision. If you're unsure and unclear about it, then let's work a little bit more on figuring out what that unclarity is. That there are alternatives and choices. There's very few situations when there's no choice. Very few. I won't close the door completely, but it's much a smaller group than we really think. To be responsible, to stop and think rather than, well, it's not my fault. If you would have only done what you were supposed to do, and you're such a slow poker, you're such an idiot, or you never think it through, or you never consider putting the blame on somebody else. To be able to stop and think, I don't like this, or I think we need to look at this again, to do that. Speaking for yourself, taking responsibility for how you feel rather than dumping it on somebody else. To act on thoughts rather than acting out feelings. What's my interpretation of what that information is that I've gained through any of my senses so that I can act on it, make my decision? To be rational, to be objective, rather than getting hooked in with an emotionality. I can't do that because people are going to be, and you begin to get a lot of guilt and such dumped on top of you. I'll have to take responsibility for my actions, to be objective. To calculate, what if I do this, what's going to happen? If I don't do this, what's going to happen? And if I do something else, what would happen? And as I figure out those consequences, then I can feel comfortable with making that decision myself, rather than, I'm just a puppet out there. Somebody's got to decide for me. Somebody's got to move me. Somebody's got to tell me what to do, because I will make a mistake. I'll do it wrong. Be flexible, develop some emotional muscle. Well, yes, I guess I did goof up on that. Now, how can I fix it, or how can I learn from it, rather than, well, that's the way I am, that's the way I'll always be, take me or leave me. It's my way or the highway. You know, I hear a lot of people saying that. Well, if you don't do it this way, then forget about it. That whole necessity of, if I don't have control, then who am I? Who am I? Who am I? Do I experience myself as a victim or a victor? Remember, when you begin to think of yourself as a victim, to say, but I'm a survivor. If I were just a victim, I wouldn't be surviving. I wouldn't be here any longer. So how can I work through this? That I can overcome it. Now, when we deal with somebody who has been sexually abused, there's a little bit different focus on that. They have been made a victim by someone, but we don't need to stay in that. You know, it's not their fault that they've been raped. That's still, a lot of policemen still believe that women ask for it. Rape is not a sexual issue, it is a power issue. And we need to recognize, yes, it was not my fault, but I am going to be a survivor of this, and I will be a victor in it, and I will not continue to experience myself as a victim. how do I find that mature character in the sense of self that looks at the long haul? What do I really want 5 years from now? What's going to happen next winter? What's going to happen? What do I want to work for? Rather than right now. I've got to have it right now. I don't care what happens. You know, I'll spend everything right now. I may not have anything for the rest of the month, but I just want this right now. How can we recognize that there's a broader focus? Any comments or questions you have on some of this before we go on to look at another, how we can think about ourselves? Comments?
Well, yeah. I guess I just have a little bit of a preference to the word that you use, survivor, instead of victor, because I'm not sure that in life that very often I'm a victor, but I
do survive.
But yes, survival is important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because victor implies somebody's did not win. Somebody got conquered.
Yeah. I probably should change that, and that would be a good. I would agree with your explanation of that. And to look at, not necessarily that somebody has to lose in order for you to win, but there can be several survivors. We can survive. Thank you.
Well, I like victor in the sense that you're comparing with victim, though.
Yeah.
You're a victor over whatever happened to you, not necessarily somebody else, but yourself.
I have won.
Exactly.
I have managed to survive this, and that makes me a winner.
Situation.
Okay, so there's a place for both. But the important part is not that you have to make somebody else a loser, but that we can win this. Yes.
This is throw out too. Looking at the positive column as being objective and rational and objective, that we worship at that font, whatever. And what's wrong with the emotional?
Some emotion, but notice it says emotionally hooked.
Right, it's emotionally now, hooked, you can also be excited and enthusiastic.
Yeah, but most often emotionally hooked might be, I'm really angry and I'm just going to, I turn off my thinking and I'm not going to look clearly at this because this is the way I feel strongly about it. And it can be a roadblock. It can be closing the door rather than opening the door. Certainly, being excited, I'm not tuning out all parts of emotionality, but it's being hooked into something, being hooked into a lot of guilt, being hooked into anger, being hooked into
pity me.
So it's linked to that the hook on it. I don't want to rule out all emotions. I mean, emotions aren't right or wrong. Even anger, guilt, pity aren't right or wrong. It's how we act on them that becomes judged. It's how we put it into action. If I really feel pity and I'm going to stay around and cry and just lament and, you know, just be a blob, unable to do anything forever and ever, amen, then my actions are going to be a victim. I can say, this isn't fair, this isn't right, and I can find some way to work on that, and I can be the survivor, I can be the victor. I won't be hooked and kept down at that one. Don?
I think the line just above it also has a place in the right left-hand column, because I think very little of romance really winds up on the acts on thoughts, but you're acting on some feeling. Mm-hmm. I think it can be a very proactive element to act on feelings. Mm-hmm. Just to react to feelings is a dangerous part, but to act on feelings makes it very proactive.
So we might put the acts on thoughts and feelings on the left-hand side.
I think he was tapping into the whole rationality that has to be so predominant. And we have a tough time for it. Putting feelings into some kind of credible framework sometimes.
And a lot of times our feelings are a result of our interpretation of our thoughts. As we look at a wheel of awareness, I mean, we get something through our senses. We hear or we see or there's some touch, feel, smell. And then we have some interpretation of that, you know, one way or another. It can be very negative or be very positive, and that will affect how we feel about it.
I think a lot of romance, so it's
yeah.
Like
yeah.
Pretty proactive.
Yeah. Yeah, and.
If you're talking about feelings of anger, you had not too good to act them out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, let me go on. Well, as we're working with self-esteem and life is uncertain, eat dessert first, how do we find some joy and how do we find some support for myself as being that child of God now? We are already children of God now. How can we make it a point to think positively about ourselves? Can we make it a point to be our own best friend? And being that best friend means giving yourself some acceptance. I'm okay. Sure, I'll make mistakes sometimes. You'll make mistakes sometimes. It's okay. There's forgiveness there. Albert Ellis is the father of rational emotive therapy. And when I was doing some graduate work, I had to do a report on a book by Albert Ellis, Guide to Rational Living. And at that time that book report was due, my husband was having open heart surgery. Our daughters were, 9 and 12 at the time, and I was teaching. There was a lot of responsibilities. I took over some of Paul's campus ministry work, and it was Harry. So I went to my professor, and I said, I can't do this right now. And he said, well, just do a quick thing. You know, it's 120 pages, very short. You can do it very quickly. So I went back, and I started to read the book, and I got to about page 30 or so, and here, Albert Ellis dumps on anything that connected with the Christian church. Well, I couldn't take any more of that at the time. I was carrying enough of a load, and I went back to my professor the next day, and I told him what I said, and I said, I can't deal with this right now. There is just too much going on. He said, okay, finish it when you can. So sometime later, when things got straightened out, I went back to the book, and at about page 80 or so, Albert Ellis, invents forgiveness. I almost threw the book down again. And then I decided, well, wait a minute. There's something more to this. That when I do work, I'm doing work with people other than just Christians. And it gives me one more support link to say, not only is it a gift of God and the forgiveness and through the death on the cross of Christ, but here is even Albert Ellis who says forgiveness is important. So, you know, can we accept and even forgive ourselves? That comes down as the later one, too. Encouragement. How do we encourage ourselves? What do we really say? What a stupid idiot when I make a mistake, or what am I going to learn from that? You can't learn less. Can you take pride in your own accomplishments, or do we keep having to put a wet blanket on them and hide them, put them in a clothes box? No, that's not fair. That wasn't very much at all. I mean, we so often diminish what we do rather than just being thank you. I mean, we don't have to say, oh, yeah, wasn't it? Well, sometimes it might be okay to say that, too. Isn't it really worked out? That is something, or most of that's okay. Yes?
And also, it's hard to, when you get it.
Yeah, and here you want to give a gift, and they're rejecting it. So, in a sense, you feel sort of rejected. They don't want my gift. Time. Do you give yourself time? Do you even take 10 minutes in the morning to do some exercise? Now, we'd probably be better if we could do 20 or 30. But can you take some of that time to do some exercise, to do some meditating, to do some thinking, to plan ahead? Nobody's going to give it to you. You have to take it. You have to plan for it, fit it in somewhere. Do you trust yourself? Yeah, I'm okay at that. I can do this. Or, I still need to work a little bit more on this, and then I'll have it. So that trust. Do you respect yourself? We all want other people to respect us. But what respect do we give ourselves? Love? Can you love yourself? Not until we can really, truly understand what love is ourselves can we give it on the outside. Can we share it? Because it's almost then, well, if I give it away, what'll I have left? That kind of grasping. Forgiveness for mistakes, talked about that a little bit earlier. The courage to take risks. Well, maybe I don't know all there is to know about that particular. Well, where can I find it out? Who can I get somebody to help me? How can we work through this? So, to think positive.
Babe Ruth. held the home run record for a generation. What is not widely known is that he also had the strikeout record. In other words, he was willing to take some risks.
Take some risks. Well, looking at your strengths, where do we find some of our strengths? And one that I believe we all come with this name tag indelibly embossed upon us by our Creator that says, I am lovable and capable. Not just you, but so am I. We all are. I often use a little name tag for my classes that has IALAC on the bottom of it. And one time, Paul and I were doing a marriage enrichment program at a Lutheran church back in the Syracuse area some years ago. And we use name tags with this. And we asked the group, do you have any idea what IALAC stands for? Blank faces. No smile. All of a sudden, there was one gentleman. His eyes began to twinkle and his mouth began to curve up, and he raised his hand. He said, I know what it stands for. It stands for I am Lutheran and cuddly. And so are you. Or if Lutheran doesn't happen to fit that category, I'm lovable and cuddly, or lovable and capable, learning about caring, whatever. You are in charge of how you feel. No one can make you feel without your permission. No one can make you feel inferior. No one can make you feel mad. No one can make you feel glad. I mean, if somebody comes up to you and says, come on, smile. You look so great when you smile. You might end up smiling because you're embarrassed. You might end up smiling just to get me off your back. You might end up stonewalling and saying, I'm determined I'm not going to smile. I'm not going to smile. So you are in charge of how you feel. I can't make you feel anything. Accept yourself. Smile. It gives a joy around you, and then other people are going to wonder what's really going on inside of you. It leads them to question that. And it feels good. I think another important thing to remember is that it takes 34 muscles to frown, but it only takes 17 to smile. So think of that as a bargain. You can get two smiles for the price of one frown. One of the sentence stems that I found very helpful is the one that says, up until now. I mean, so often we meet up with people, that's just the way of them, that's the way, especially in the church. We've always done it this way. Or we have never done it this way. So to be able to say, up until now, I've found this, but there might be some other possibilities, that there's always possibility for change. If you're really looking at strengthening self-esteem and looking at your strengths, you might try a success chart or a victory log or a strengths list. Now, a success chart, you might be, if you happen to be 30 years old, for instance, you might divide it into your life into thirds, the first 10 years, the second 10 years, the third 10 years, and then write down five or as many successes as you can think of in those years. You passed first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade. You learned how to ride a bicycle. You learned how to feed yourself without poking yourself in the nose. And you know, what are those successes from the littlest ones that you would have taken for, you take for granted now? But riding that bicycle was a big thing when you were 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8, whenever it was that you first rode it. Maybe 10 or 15. But looking back at it now doesn't mean to diminish. That was an important thing then. Yes?
Another idea is to have a blue folder.
A blue folder. Tell us about that.
It's actually blue. My wife has one. I've got one. And like you said, you put these things inside of there.
Yeah.
The only problem is hers is thicker than mine.
Remember we said self-esteem is not... Remember we said self-esteem is not competitive. Maybe you write smaller.
I'm getting better though.
And maybe she writes bigger or uses more words. It's
somebody, not. Somebody gives you a compliment, you write it down in your journal or whatever.
Yeah.
Or somebody writes you a nice letter that's complimentary, sure. You save that.
Yes.
They tell a story about the chief executive officer of Levi Strauss. Now, how many people have Levi stuff on here today? I mean, money bags. The story is that on his desk he has one of these secretarial books with the little rings at the top and in columns.
Steno pad.
I mean, he could have a leather embossed blank book to write his thoughts in, but he takes an ordinary, inexpensive steno pad, and he writes down his successes. Got a $5 million loan to start up a factory in China. Got my son to clean his room. Managed to find a time for the family to go out for dinner together to Wendy's. I mean, so he puts in not only his business accomplishments, but even his family. And each time he has some new challenge to reach, he flips through his book to say, I've had successes. I can do it again. Speak for yourself. Use I messages. I need, I would like, I would find it helpful, rather than, you never think about me. You're always doing it wrong. Why? Well, we could go. Take ownership. What are your needs? How do you feel? Remember, nobody can make you feel something without your permission. So I feel is important. Check out what you hear. Actively listen. Because we always come to listening with our own set of experiences, our own perceptions. And we may hear something completely different from someone else. The different words. So we might check back. You're saying that you really like that. No, I didn't. That was the worst thing. Well, wow, I really got it. So check out what you hear. Then, no matter what you say or do to me, I'm still a worthwhile person is a kind of mantra to say to ourselves. No matter what happens, I'm still worth. I can make a mistake. I can learn from it. I'm still a worthwhile person. God still loves me. God doesn't have conditional love. We have conditional love, and we want to try to get away from that as much as we can. No matter what you say or do to me, I'm still a worthwhile person. And then, I want you to do an exercise that reminds you of your own self-esteem and supporting your self-esteem, and that is, look at your hand. Just pretend it's a mirror, because this is the kind of thing you can do when you pass a window and you see your reflection in the window, or you pass a mirror. So just practice with your hand. Pretend it's a mirror, and you wiggle your nose and see your nose wiggle in the reflection in that mirror, and sort of look at yourself. Where are your eyes and your nose and your glasses? Do they need washing or whatever? But then as you look at that mirror, go to yourself. And you can also add, I'm okay, or I'm lovable and capable. But let's try that again. Just look at your hand. You're going to look at your hand. Everybody else is looking at their hand, so you don't need to feel embarrassed. Nobody's looking at you. And go, I'm okay. Let's do it again. I'm okay.
Dirty.
The washroom is down the hall. How do we reaffirm ourselves? And even I often assign that as an assignment in any class that I teach, whether it's on anger or self-esteem or parenting or time management, as a kind of encouragement of myself. And so many people say, I couldn't do that. Somebody walk past me and say, you're out of your mind. They'll call for an ambulance to come and take me to the psychiatric center because they'll think I've gone off my rocker. Why would we go off our rocker in encouraging ourselves? I mean, those are some lessons that we have learned that have not been very helpful to our own sense of self, our own being that which God has meant us to be. How do we say, I'm okay. I am even now a child of God. I don't have to wait. I am now. So how do we find that joy that says, I'm okay, and so are you? I'd like to just close with this little statement of self-esteem, a declaration of self-esteem by Virginia Satir. Virginia Satir is a family therapist she's done some good things in self-esteem too. And this is my declaration of self-esteem. I am me. In all the world, there is no one else exactly like me. There are persons who have some parts like me, but no one adds up exactly like me. Therefore, everything that comes out of me is authentically mine because I alone choose it. I own everything about me, my body, including everything it does, including all its thoughts and ideas, my eyes, including the images of all they behold, my feelings, whatever they may be, anger, joy, frustration, love, disappointment, excitement, my mouth and all the words that come out of it, polite, sweet or rough, correct or incorrect, my voice, loud or soft, and all my actions, whether they be to others or to myself. I own my fantasies, my dreams, my hopes, my fears. I own all my triumphs and successes, all my failures and mistakes. Because I own all of me, I can become intimately acquainted with me. By so doing, I can love me and be friendly with me in all my parts. I can then make it possible for all of me to work in my best interests. I know there are aspects about myself that puzzle me and other aspects I do not know, but as long as I am friendly and loving to myself, I can courageously and hopefully look for the solutions to the puzzles and for ways to find out more about me. However I look and sound, whatever I say and do, and whatever I think and feel at any given moment in time is me. This is authentic and represents where I am at that moment in time. When I review later how I looked and sounded, what I said and did, and how I thought and felt, some parts may turn out to be unfitting. I can discard that which is unfitting and keep that which proved fitting and invent something new for that which I'd discarded. I can see, hear, think, feel, say, and do. I have the tools to survive, to be close to others, to be productive, and to make sense and order out of the world of people and things outside of me. I own me, and therefore I can engineer me. I am me, and I am okay. Okay, let's have some comments or questions or clarification stories. Yes.
I think of some of the people who we've had to deal with really have an overrated ego about themselves.
Yeah.
And it's not just a matter of having a Christian virtue, but I think there's something in a lot of us that says that humility is a matter of honesty, not just a Christian virtue.
Yeah.
We almost feel sorry for these people that just have unreal self-assurance.
Yeah, and I'm not so convinced that that's a strong sense of self-esteem as it is an inflated or a bolstered, because they really don't feel that good about themselves. And they've got to prove to somebody else, they've got to balloon it so that people know what they don't really know.
Well, that steers me in the track. What is really honest about myself? I better be pretty humble about it.
Well, I think we also can be very honest, and there's a difference between saying, I did make that dress, or I did write that book, or I did make that meal, or I did paint that picture. I like it. Now, it may not be everybody else's cup of tea, but I'm really delighted with the way it turned out. Now, if you can go say, now that's really worth it. Nobody else can do anything like it, and that's the best, and nobody better even try. I think that's that kind of inflated sense that, you know, nobody can match you. But there's a kind of middle point that I think we can bloat and inflate, or we can be honest and comfortable, and we don't have to be self-deprecating. No, I really can't do anything. I mean, so we want to be able to look and to say, yeah, I like that. And I can feel comfortable with it. Maybe somebody else doesn't.
Well, one reason seems to me that we have trouble accepting ourselves is that we know ourselves too well. And even though we know we have some successes and we know we do these things, yet you know all the little goofs that went along with it.
Okay.
And it's easy to still recognize those and not willing to accept even kudos from somebody else, because we're too hard on ourselves. We don't give ourselves enough credit, and we dwell on those little uncertainties, mistakes, goofs, weaknesses.
Yeah. And we sometimes feel an overwhelming burden. They're going to expect me to be able to do this again, and I may not be able to do it another time, rather than rejoice in the fact that it's now done here. Or we think, what are the other people going to think if I say, yeah, I like that? We're sort of embarrassed that we succeed. We've had a lot of good instruction through our many years of life that has put us down, or we've seen others put down, or that we've seen false, bloated egos, and we say, no, I don't want that, so I've got to stay away from it, without realizing that there's another way to look at that.